Over the years, one of the most popular people I've had on the program is Michael Marmot, an expatriate Australian who's Professor of Epidemiology and Public Health at University College London. His research has focused on the gradient in health, sickness and life expectancy between people who have the resources to be in control of their lives and those who don't. The factors which determine this health gap, these health inequities, are more to do with schools, transport, work, income and our physical environment than what doctors or nurses do. Michael, now Sir Michael, who was in Australia last week, chaired a global commission on these social determinants for the World Health Organization and prescribed a set of policies for governments to follow, which require significant political change and social investment. So you can imagine my surprise when I'd heard he'd become president of the British Medical Association, not known as a hotbed of revolutionary zeal.
You think you were surprised? You imagine how I felt.
What happened? What's the story?
Well, they rang me and said, would you like to be president of the BMA? And I said, you must know what I do. And they said, yeah, we know what you do. And I said, I've spent my whole career saying that the real determinants of health lie outside the healthcare system. Why would you want me to be president of the BMA? And they said, we'd like you to talk about it. I said, I'm not going to stop talking about health inequalities just because I'm president of the BMA. They said, that's fine. So, in fact, what I've been doing this year as president of the BMA is asking, how can the medical profession get engaged with this issue?
So has the BMA had this sort of radical political transformation or what?
Well, my view of the BMA was more disinterest than impolite before I became president. And they are a trade union. They're concerned about paying conditions for doctors. But I think what they wanted and what I've been doing is somebody to take, dare I say it, the high moral ground to say social injustice is causing health inequalities. And as doctors, we're concerned about this.
But the role of doctors is difficult. You know, the one-on-one medical consultation ain't going to do much for social justice.
I'm pushing that there should be three roles for doctors in this regard, looking at social determinants of health. The first that I say, let's put our own house in order. So in the one-on-one consultation, let's make sure that we've got universal access. There are not differences in access based on ability to pay, for example.
This is to healthcare.
In healthcare. And that healthcare be more prevention orientated and more oriented to health promotion. So there's much that the individual doctor can do working as an individual doctor. Secondly, partnership working and advocacy. If you're the Minister of Health, you should be the advocate across government for health inequalities, social determinants of health. If you're a GP working at the coalface, partnership working, early child development, social services, the voluntary sector, people involved in alcohol, smoking, schooling, working with others. And we have, not many, but we have examples of general practices in the UK that really do this. They really are committed to partnership working. In East London, there's a general practice that's in a heavily immigrant area. 40% of their patients are Bangladeshi. They teach them English.
They teach them English in the general practice?
They teach them English. Well, the general practice is part of a community centre, and they have 100 different programmes, language classes, occupational skills training, helping people with job interviews, community development, early child development. Now, they've been challenged. I was on the BBC with the general practitioner, and the interviewer said, but that's not your job. You're supposed to treat patients, aren't you? What are you doing all that? And the interviewer turned to me and said, should he be doing this? And I said, well, of course. How can people stay well if they can't get a job? They've got to be into work. They've got to earn money. They've got to have a role in society if their health's going to improve. And so the general thrust, and I've quoted in this context, quoted Rudolf Virchow, 19th century.
So just to explain, Rudolf Virchow was a great pathologist. A lot of modern pathology, in fact, is based on his work, but he was also politically radical.
He was indeed. And he said that physicians are the natural attorneys of the poor. And by that, he means, as doctors, we see the effects of living with social disadvantage. We should be the natural attorneys of the poor. So we see the effects. And the slogan we had for the WHO Commission on Social Determinants of Health was, why treat people and return them to the conditions that made them sick in the first place? So if you're the one-on-one doc and you're seeing people who are suffering from the effects of the conditions in which they're born, grow, live, work and age, surely it's too narrow a definition of your work simply to treat the ill health effects. You've got to address the broader concerns.
So as president of the Doctors Trade Union in Britain, how does the way you remunerate GPs or specialists indeed have to change to allow that to happen?
Well, I've not got involved with questions of remuneration, for example. It's more, and for example, I'm trying to get the GPs, with some success, GPs at the British Medical Association engaged with this issue, in their broader responsibilities along these lines of advocacy, partnership working. And what we're doing at the moment is gathering good examples of where general practitioners are already doing this. Their remuneration system remains unchanged, but they're working with other services to improve the life and conditions of their patients and hence improve their health.
Do you think that sort of project, and you trained in Australia, you know the Australian system, can work in fee-for-service? It's not fee-for-service in Britain. You get effectively a salary from the government based on how many patients you have on your list as a general practitioner, which means that, in fact, there's an incentive to make your patients healthier because your workload will go down or you can shift it to more productive areas. Here, you get paid by the number of people you see an hour. Do you think that you can actually broaden to that more partnership-focused, preventive, upstream focus in the Australian context?
I think we should be trying to move in that direction. I mean, let's have the discussion. Let's actually get it on the agenda. And if you say, well, the current system of remunerating general practitioners does not favour that, then let's ask, well, what would we have to do to take this broader approach to patient health and population health? Now, I'm still pushing the fact that this is not primarily a function of doctors. It relates to the broader society.
But there's something they can do.
But there's something doctors can do. And if the way medical care is organised is against partnership working, the advocacy role is still very important. And whether it's the Australian Medical Association, which is doing good things, I mean, they've been very active on the smoking issue, for example, and the minister this morning addressing the Council of the World Medical Association made these strong announcements about commitment to anti-smoking, which is not just what an individual doctor does with an individual patient, but it's how can the general smoking environment change to try and deal with it. And the AME, the Australian Medical Association, has been very strong on that issue. So the role of doctor as advocate shouldn't be underplayed.
Now, you did this, and we spoke about this some years ago, you did this huge report for the World Health Organization on the social determinants of health. In other words, you know, economic, social, political factors, transport, the environment, etc., that influence our health, with a whole series of recommendations, dropped it on their desk. What's happened to it?
Well, it's a good question. There's some tangible effects to which I can point and some intangible ones. Let me start with the tangible. I never thought I'd get to the stage of my life where I thought a resolution at the World Health Assembly was important. That shows what happens when you get too old. But we had a resolution at the World Health Assembly in 2009 demanding that the Director General of WHO take action on the social determinants of health and report back to the World Health Assembly on what she'd done. Secondly, it called for a global summit on social determinants of health where all countries be asked to report on what they've been doing. The government of Brazil came forward and said, we'll host it. It will take place in Rio de Janeiro in October 2011. That was a recommendation we made.
You've got people's attention.
We've got people's attention. Brazil's hoping to have 120 ministries of health represented at this summit in Rio. Thirdly, a number of governments have taken it on. And let me just give you the example of Britain. The Secretary of State for Health, the senior health minister in England, said, how could we apply the findings of the WHO Global Commission to England? Would I conduct a review of health inequalities in England, which I did, and we reported in February 2010, last year.
Just before the election.
Just before the election.
And what were the main findings?
We had six domains of recommendations. Give every child the best start in life, so the importance of early child development, education and lifelong learning, employment and working conditions, minimum income for healthy living. Really radical. We said in a rich society, everybody should have the minimum necessary for a healthy life, the importance of sustainable communities, community development, and sixth, taking a social determinants approach to prevention. So we made the set of recommendations, and the question was, what would happen after the election?
And did the Cameron government pick up on it?
Remarkably, yes. This has a history. 30 years ago, Sir Douglas Black,
who was president of the Royal College of Physicians, not the BMA,
who was president of the Royal College of Physicians, conducted a report for the then Labour government on inequalities in health. By the time he reported, Mrs. Thatcher was prime minister, there was a Conservative government, and they buried the report. They wouldn't publish it and said, we're not going to take action. We're not going to do this. The then Secretary of State for Health wrote a very damning preface to the report and said, we will not implement this, and buried it. It got a lot of publicity around the world, but it was did not become part of government policy. So the question was, would Marmot go the way of Black? And the answer is no. The coalition government in Britain produced a public health white paper at the end of last year. Right at the top of the public health white paper, it said, this is a response to the review by Sir Michael Marmot on health inequalities. We will put health inequalities right at the centre of our public health focus, and we recognise that we're not going to solve it through the healthcare system, but we have to take action on the wider determinants of health. And they took up five of my six recommendations.
And which one didn't they?
It's funny you should ask that. Minimum income for healthy living. And I said to the Secretary of State for Health, you didn't take that one up, and he looked uncomfortable. And I tried to let him off the hook by saying, well, I guess this was a public health white paper from the Department of Health, not from the Treasury. And he said, no, you can't let me off the hook that way. This is a government public health white paper.
So he was claiming cabinet solidarity here?
He was claiming cabinet solidarity, but he wasn't trying to pretend that they had taken up the minimum income for healthy living, because, in fact, living standards will decline. That's what the governor of the Bank of England has said with the credit crisis. He said this will be the most sustained reduction in living standards that we've had in Britain for a very long time.
And health inequalities will increase?
Well, that's the worry. That's the worry. And so the question is the extent to which implementation of my recommendations might mitigate against the adverse economic and social climate.
And indeed, there is some international evidence for that. When the World Bank put out its World Development Report in 1993, I think Chile in 1993 had a better life expectancy than America, yet only had the per capita income of America in 1893. So it's not all about money.
It's not all about money, most certainly not. And Chile, Costa Rica, Cuba, Sri Lanka, remarkably good health despite being relatively low income. So it's not all about money. It's very much about social conditions. So thinking about the fact that we had six recommendations, only one of them was about money directly. Now, giving every child the best start in life takes money, but not necessarily so much. I mean, for example, we pointed to the fact that there's a social gradient in early child development. By that I mean the lower you are in the income or social hierarchy, the worse the early child development. Half of that deficit in early child development can be reversed by reading to children daily. That's not a very expensive intervention, reading to children daily. Now, if parents are ground down by poverty and misery and postnatal depression and scarcely literate themselves, no books in the house, we must be able to find a way to support parents, to help them read to children. Now, that takes some money, it takes some organization, and it takes some will. But that's the sort of thing that can be done even in an adverse economic climate.
Now, in England, and I say England advisedly, the administration of education and, in fact, a lot of social services are through local councils, city councils. So city councils almost have the same authority as state governments do in Australia. And I believe some local councils are taking up some of these recommendations.
This has been wonderful. It's been really wonderful. As you say, you produce a report, you metaphorically slap it on someone's desk, and the question is, does anybody do anything? We know of 30 local areas in England that have implementation plans for my inequalities review. I was at a meeting 2 weeks ago of local government people. On the one hand, they're depressed about having to face 28% cuts over the next 4 years. Very challenging, is the code word. On the other hand, really enthusiastic about, as they put it, implementing Marmot. They have, in Birmingham, they have champions for each of the six domains of our recommendations.
Six domains, not five.
They have champions in each of the six domains. And figures from Birmingham, for example, the West Midlands, where Birmingham is more deprived than the English average, and Birmingham is more deprived than the West Midlands average. You see the adverse early child development scores, but they've improved them. They've caught up. They're actually now up at the English average, despite greater levels of deprivation. They put real emphasis on doing it, and they've done it. And one of the questions we've asked them is, what did you do? I mean, how did you manage this? This is terrific. But it's really inspiring that if people put effort into it, focus on it, despite high levels of deprivation, they can make a real difference.
And you're going to do this for Europe too now?
The regional director of WHO for the European region, and the European region of WHO includes all of the former Soviet Union, so it spreads to the Bering Strait. It's nearly spreads as far as Alaska. So it's very diverse. I mean, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan have life expectancy equivalent to sub-Saharan Africa.
And some very ugly political regimes.
So on the one hand, we've got Iceland and Sweden and Norway, which look absolutely remarkable in the predictable direction. And to the east of the region, they look very different. But she's asked me to conduct a review on social determinants and the health divide for Euro. And she wants to make this the centerpiece of a new public health strategy. And she wants member states to take it up. So a bit like we've done in England, where we've got partners with a number of local areas, we're hoping to have partner countries in the Euro region. We already have Norway, Denmark, and Slovenia. But, for example, in Sweden, where the national government hasn't declared themselves as a partner, but the city of Malmö has.
Sir Michael Marmot of University College London and currently president of the British Medical Association.